Hello, I'm Hashim Montasser, and you're listening to The Lighthouse Conversations, a podcast featuring entrepreneurs and tastemakers from the worlds of arts, culture, tech, and of course, food. In September 2019, Jennifer Lopez walked out on the red carpet of the Toronto Film Festival in a mustard yellow ruffled dress for the premiere of her movie Hustlers. It immediately made the headlines, and what made the gown even more special is that it was designed by the Dubai-based studio Maison Yeya. Maison Yeya was established over a decade ago by Yasmin Yeya. Yasmin, like myself, was born and raised in Egypt and spent some time in Dubai working in advertising before going back home and making a name for herself as a designer. I feel like we already know each other from a long time, which is not the case, but I feel I've known you for a long time, just right after the lockdown. We were both invited to a dinner party, and then we spoke either the next day or 2 days after, and you and I were talking, we were both Egyptian, so to start with, and I've just discovered that you grew up in Ismailia, so yes. We're going to talk about that as well. But we spoke about, A, what it feels like to be Egyptian and living here, and also amongst a relatively small community of Egyptians that are entrepreneurs, that run their own businesses, and the pros and cons of that, and the challenges that come with that, in the sense of how people perceive us broadly as Egyptians. Tell us a little bit about your own experience.
When I used to live in Egypt, I didn't really see that. You start discovering that people don't expect you to be successful or doing something that is a little bit avant-garde just because you're Egyptian. Mm-hmm.
And
There is a stigma. Well, I think we're 100 million, right?
Mm-hmm. And plus.
We're 100 million plus. This is what we know of. And we have so many socioeconomic sectors in the same society that have totally different education, totally different value systems even. And what the people actually see is so different from what we know in Egypt. So, and usually successful Egyptians tend to stay in Egypt.
Correct.
They're doing well and tend to stay in Egypt. And a lot of the working class that go out, they have totally different education and totally different set of values. And these are the people that probably would see them at the Gulf.
Correct.
Or in the other countries.
So you see blue-collar workers.
Exactly. And we have a lot of them.
And a lot of them. Obviously, we export a lot of people, generally to the Gulf especially.
Exactly.
So then, were you aware of that when you decided to move here? Because you were in Egypt and you were successful and you have built a brand for yourself. Did that come up, the concept of, oh, I'm going to now be an Egyptian in the Gulf with whatever perception comes of that?
I never even saw it. I am someone by default that I always look at opportunities. I overtrust my capabilities, whether it's true or not. But I'm always someone who's like, I'm going to do it. But I didn't even see this as a hurdle, because in Egypt, you don't see it. We're very self-sufficient. You are...
And very inward looking.
Yeah. Exactly.
In the good and the bad, yeah.
Yeah. So definitely not, no. I didn't even see it.
So what made you decide, let me move to Dubai? I know your sister was living here, so that must have been a factor.
Actually, I used to live here from 2003 to 2007.
Okay.
I started my career here. I used to work in advertising agencies, not on the creative side, on the client servicing side. And I stayed here for 4 years. I came back to Egypt when I decided I want to become a fashion designer. I want to launch my business. So I went back to Egypt, and then I came here 2016.
And can I just pause for a second? What prompted that decision? I mean, you studied architecture, am I right?
Back? No, I studied finance.
Finance, or even further away from, I read somewhere that was architecture, my bad.
So I wanted to be an architect. When I was in school, I wanted to be an
Maybe
architect.
I've always
wanted to do something in the arts. I used to draw and paint. I had the artistic side very prominent in my personality and my interests. But then, for some reason or another, in our culture, the Arabic culture, art is not a real job. Right? So you have a high GPA, you take with all the GPA, the highest. So I went to business administration school, finance, and that's just to follow the mentality of the parents or the what we think of is a success or a real job. And I did very well. I love finance too. But then at the end of the school, I started taking art classes because this is what I also love to do. And then when I came here, I worked in advertising, and fashion is always something that I know how to sew since a very young age. My mom used to make our clothes, and to me, it was something that I knew how to do. My sister was getting married, and I had to make a dress to wear. I wanted to buy a dress
for myself,
for myself to attend the wedding. At that time, I used to make 5,000 dirhams as an account, junior account executive. So I went to all the stores. The dresses that I would love are like 30,000 dirhams and plus. I was like,
can't afford it.
And I can afford it, and I can do it. It's not difficult. And I look at them, this, the material there is like probably worth 200, 300 dirhams. So I said, you know what? I went to Satwa, to a place in Satwa. I bought some fabrics. I went to cut it in my house. And I didn't have a sewing machine at the time. I went to a tailor on Satwa. I gave him 200 dirhams. And I told him, listen, I'm going to give you this money for you to step out of the machine. I tried to explain to him first what I want.
And you took over the machine.
I told him, can you please step
step aside, step sir. Aside. I'm taking over.
I gave him 200 dirhams. I said, would you please let me? It was such a funny thing in Satwa, me with my...
I wish we had pictures of
it. Yes. And it started from then.
You went, you took over the sewing machine. And you had the confidence to go to your sister's wedding, which was not a small event for you or for her,
actually,
with something completely untried?
It was a hit. This is what actually made me say, you know what? I love doing this.
So you went there and people started complimenting your dress.
My friends and her friends would go to me, when you know, all the to the powder room and said, oh, so you live in Dubai. Would you please let us know from where did you buy your dress? We go to Dubai and we can't find stuff that as nice. I said, I did it. He said, no way. I said, I swear I did it. Mm. Look at the stitches. They're not very perfect. Mm. I did it. And then my friends started commissioning me doing dress for them.
That's
and then
started.
I came back here. My colleagues at work, I made friends dresses for them. And it started like that.
I love the story, first of all, I have to say. But, you know, you studied finance. So clearly you knew the kind of risks that it takes to start a business. Because one thing is the kind of sexiness that you hear of fashion designer. It's very glamorous. It's very sexy. It's very prominent. But it's a business at the end of the day, and it's not an easy business. Like any business, it has its difficulties. Did you stop for a second and consider that when you started your business and you said, you know what, I'm talented, I'm just going to give it a try and see where it goes? Was there a hesitancy for you to start the business?
I believe that some people are born entrepreneurs. Mm. And if you are from that kind of breed, I think that you wouldn't settle for a job where people tell you what to do, and you want to have the room to be able to do what you think is right. And no one can tell you that this is not going to happen. You're going to make it happen. And this is what drove
And you
me.
Felt you're one of those
Oh my
people.
God, I couldn't. I mean, I couldn't stay in a job. I said, and to me to take fashion is like, well, I know how to do that. I love doing it. To me, it's not a job. And I don't want to be an employee, so let me try. So, yeah, I never thought. And plus also, fashion is not it's not a big investment. You don't put a lot of investment in it.
No, sure. It's mostly your craftsmanship.
Yes.
And why did you focus primarily on bridal gowns as opposed to kind of general fashion?
That's actually a funny story, because a lot of the things that happened to me in my career are actually by pure coincidence. So I started by making short, sexy dresses, party dresses.
Okay.
Because again, I didn't want to be tied down to customized, and that was not my thing. I said, I'm going to go to Egypt, get a couple of tailors, make some nice, you know,
cocktail dresses.
At the time, I was 24, and that was the life, you know. You work in the morning, you party at the evening. So I found a shortage into a certain sector in the market, which is interesting, accessible in terms of, I mean, cheap or not very expensive party dresses. So I started doing that. From that, I started getting people that wanted to customize, and that was more money for me. So a lot of my decisions were based on, actually, you know what, this is being, the finance would come kick in now.
Commercial decisions.
Commercial
yeah.
decisions, yeah. So I started doing evening customizations. And then I got married, I got pregnant. And when I got pregnant, I wanted to stay with my kids in the beginning. I wanted to have longer projects. I wanted to be able to spend more time with my kids. And by default, I said, okay, I'm going to only take bridal gowns right now.
Mm.
When I started doing the bridal,
something clicked.
It's like I was always meant to do bridal. Yeah. It really went very well.
You were like the Vera Wang of the Middle East.
I started to be known for that. And it was a coincidence, because the decision came from me wanting to just take longer projects.
Where do you draw your inspirations from for that? Is it that you wake up in the morning and think, you know, for the next year, I'm going to work with this material, these colors? Or how does it all come together, that whole creative process?
This is a very interesting. I get asked all the time.
Sure.
Whenever there is an interview, And to tell you the truth, I never had an answer for that, so I always used to make up an answer.
Okay.
Like I get inspired from, I don't know, the beauty of
Let's not make up an answer.
I'm telling you, because recently, I've been thinking about that. Mm. Recently, I was like, I can't be asked, where do I really get my inspiration from? And I discovered that I'm someone who any artist, I guess, you find it easier to express yourself through your art medium. Okay, so in my case, I love fabrics and I love colors and I love fabrics. And everything that happens to me throughout the days, I always look at beautiful things. I mean, we could be sitting here, the moment I walked in, I appreciated the beauty and the feel of this floor. Thank it you. Has a certain kind, it gives me calm. And I think subconsciously, this gets registered sure. inside. And the day that I decide to make a collection, all of these moments start coming out subconsciously without me knowing.
Well, because of social media, we're a little bit privy to your thinking because I follow you on Instagram. And I was going to try to answer it for you. How ridiculous. Because I can see from your posts, personal posts, that a lot of things, nature, colors, things that you see that you're posting about are clearly being processed as part of your inspiration, and I'm sure that's probably part of what comes out when you start.
If you look around, you see around you. Honestly, whether in nature or in people or things that around you, moments of awe and beauty. I mean, I can't explain it. It's something that happens. It's an automatic process. Yeah.
And then, so let's say you start your process every year. Do you work with a big team, a small team? Do you work alone?
We have a good team of 20 people.
And is it collaborative or you come up with the ideas and then they execute?
The creative process, no, it's at this point, it's only me because we're a small creative place. However, I have a very solid team that translates this creative vision. Like very highly skilled seamstresses and tailors and cutters, and it's very important because as a creative person, the more you're gonna have this kind of support, the more room you're gonna have for your creativity.
For your own. And where do you source your fabrics from?
In our industry, usually you have all the beading. We do a lot of embroideries in house, but a lot of the most exquisite, I love luxury material. So the most exquisite embroideries come from India.
Okay.
And all the silks come from Como or Italy. The lace from France, Belgium, and Italy. And some of the more advanced laser cut technologies come from Switzerland.
So you bring it all here.
I love, this is the most beautiful part of the job, is me traveling.
You travel
to all of
discover,
these places
okay.
to Dubai. Yeah, the purchasing trips are usually.
And then everything gets shipped here.
Yes.
And then you kind of put it together, essentially.
Yeah. So what happens also, like when I'm planning this trip, there's always a mood now. So for example, I'll tell you a story. So before Corona, I was in a trip to buy. Actually, Corona happened in March. In February, there was a buying trip. And at that time, I was very, I like philosophy and I read a little bit about philosophy. And I was reading about the idea of depth. And I started to say, let's talk about depth in my next collection. So I went and I bought blue, deep blue, gold, because of the reflection of the sun on the sea is gold. And then you go into the depth, you find the deep blue and stuff. And then Corona happened. And the fabrics arrived. And I looked at the blue and I wanted to puke. I said, I want trend. I want fuchsia. Yeah. You see?
I'm in a very different state
no,
of
no,
mind.
No, no, no. We're gonna put all of these fabrics on the side. I want fire. And I started now buying red and gold. And yeah.
And so. How did you manage during that Corona period? Offline, before we started, you were saying that one of the silver linings of the COVID pandemic is you felt that a lot of Emiratis that were essentially stuck at home started discovering your brand and your work. And that has been a blessing in disguise, essentially.
Well, we usually, I mean, from 2006 to 7 to 2016, we're predominantly in Egypt. And then the decision to come here, when a lot of Egypt is, you know, a lot of Kuwaitis and Saudis have houses in Egypt and they like to come to Egypt on all their vacations. And I started growing my Khaliji clientele from there. So I said, I was confident to come here that I already have a Khaliji clientele. When I came here, it was very surprising that the majority of my clientele was still Kuwaiti and Saudis, and we didn't have a lot of Emiratis. And also us being a bit ignorant about, I mean, the Middle East, we think that the Emirati and the Kuwaiti and the Khaliji, the Gulf, like probably we think that all Asians are the same.
And
but that's not true. Once I came here, I started discovering that the Kuwaiti has a totally different personality, inspiration, and aspiration, education than the Saudi, than the Emirati, than the Bahraini. And then when the corona, and I was always very curious about the Emirati because they're very reserved and they're very closed, and they're very different from what we know from the Kuwaitis and the Saudis predominantly. So when the corona happened, we started getting more and more Emiratis, because there was lockdown, and these people, they wanted to make smaller weddings. So we started meeting with them more and talking to them more. And I got a very interesting comment from an Emirati older lady. She told me, thank you for introducing my daughter to the Egyptian culture. Mm-hmm. So I don't think Emiratis, they don't out a lot.
Certainly didn't have the same, sorry to interrupt you, the same ties to Egypt. As you said, historically, Saudi and Kuwait have always been, as you said, come to Egypt, have homes there, come in the summers, etc.
Yeah.
Emiratis a lot less.
Yes, exactly.
And a lot of them also studied in Egypt.
Yeah. The older generation, yes, but the new generation, which is predominantly my demographic of clientele, they don't know much about Egyptian or Egypt. Yeah.
So which parts of Egyptian culture did you introduce the daughter to?
You want to know something? I always, whenever there's a bride, I do I don't know.
Zagrut. Oh, fantastic.
Yes. I'm very proud of my culture. I love my culture. And
I think Zagrut is across the Arab world. I don't think it's only Egyptian.
They don't have, I don't know, they have it here. They have it in the Levant. Mm. They have it differently than us. But our Egyptian Zagrut is very special. So we always talk about Egypt. I mean, and not only that, even if you don't even bring from where you're from, but just dealing with the people on a certain honest emotional level, when you become an ambassador for your culture. 100%. And your,
Because you work and design wedding dresses, and because that's a very emotional purchase, this is not like buying, as you said, a cocktail dress or shoes. You are coming in, you're working with prospective clients that are very charged, highly charged, probably emotional at that stage. So your job is part psychologist, part designer. How do you deal with that? I mean, do you feel these relationships are transient, or they last beyond the purchase? So the man, they come, they spend time with you.
Last way beyond. Till date, I have even clients that got married and divorced, and we're still friends, you know?
Yeah, you're still here from...
But how
do you deal with that part? That's a lot of stuff that's probably being offloaded on you.
Before I have my kids... Mm. I used to hate bridezillas. I did not understand. I did not understand this kind of psychology.
Are they all bridezillas?
It depends on their nationality, to tell you the truth. I mean, some nationalities are more bridezillas than others.
Okay.
And because it's the culture of the wedding and the expectations and
pressure.
There is on the woman. So after I got my kids and I became a mother and I have daughters, I don't know why, maybe a hormonal shift happened to me, but I started really seeing the woman at that time, whether the mother of the bride, the grandmother of the bride, or the bride herself, as a very vulnerable being.
I was going
to
say.
And I started to accommodate a lot of this neediness as me not being only a designer, but as, like, so many times I would see the bride crying, and I would tell her, you know what, put a hold on the dress, forget the dress.
Let's stop.
What's bothering you?
Yeah.
Some of them, even we still know.
So you developed empathy, really, for their situation.
And became a pleasure, became something extra, became something else completely that actually gives meaning to my job. As you said, it's a very vulnerable moment in the
process.
In the family, in the mom and in her daughter's life, and you participate in making a dream happen. So basically, the dress that I make for the woman, you see, the look that you get from her mother is priceless. The idea of me making her daughter the way she dreamt of, oh my God, it puts tears to my eyes.
That's so interesting, though, because I almost have a feeling that you were saying at the beginning, it was the process of creating the dresses, maybe a little bit less of the interaction with the actual person. Over time, you've developed kind of an understanding, a deeper understanding, connection to the client, to the customer. And part of it is understanding their vulnerabilities and accepting
even a pleasure,
and not judging it.
Not only that, it's I even developed a certain kind of pleasure and satisfaction from being able to participate in that moment. I feel honored. She would remember me for the rest of her life every time she's going to look at the pictures, you know. If she's upset and she remembers that day I made her feel better, because it's a very tough time for the bride, really. They organize everything. I don't know. Sometimes they feel like their lives is going to be changed forever. There is a lot of psychological management for the bride and her mother that used to be done at that time. And it's not about the dress anymore. It's about being part of that moment in their lives.
100%. Yeah. Are the husbands or fathers ever involved, out of curiosity?
Yes.
They are?
Yes, not the husbands. It's bad omen for us Arabs that the husband would be involved.
Okay, that's
sometimes
right. You don't
jealous
see them.
Because the bride would go and say, I met this designer and she's doing this. So why are you talking about her that much? It happened to me a lot, by the way. From the husband, he said, I really wanted to meet you because she's talking too much about you.
It's so funny.
Because you become friends, you know.
Of course.
And the process for her to do a wedding dress doesn't happen to her every day. So for her, it's a process that makes her feel good, you know. And the fathers, yes, they come. A lot of it's not a very Arab thing that the dad would be involved. But every now and then, we find a very cute dad that comes in and actually would close the zipper for his daughter
cute.
And cry when he sees his daughter with the wedding dress.
How do you, in that process, which is fraught with a lot of psychological drama, in a way. So someone's coming in, it's a new bride, she has certain ideas. You think the ideas, I'm just going to use a hypothetical example, are terrible. You have something else in mind that you think might fit her or fit that moment. Do you steer her away from her ideas, or do you say, you know, my job is to execute whatever you want? I mean, how does that dialogue go from meeting one to shaping a dress?
Okay, so yesterday, as recent as yesterday, I had a client, a beautiful girl, very soft and nice girl from Egypt, Egyptian bride. And she just wants to make a small event and she wants to wear a jumpsuit.
Interesting.
And me as... Yasmin, the design. First, I look at her body. I don't think that the jumpsuit is what's going to complement her body the most.
It's not flattering.
And thinking about her mother, I don't think that her mother, and she's the only child, would like to see her in a jumpsuit for her wedding.
It's
no?
so funny.
So
no, it's so funny that you're really getting
this. This is how I think, because I was thinking. And even for her, I mean, why would you forego this moment, you know, of you're going to have pictures and you need a wedding dress.
Did you tell her that?
I didn't tell her that. In the beginning, I didn't tell her that. So I tell her, okay, you always, there's a way. I mean, but you really can't. I mean, some people have it and some people
don't. No, that's why I'm so fascinated.
Maybe I'm a little bit manipulative.
No,
but for a good reason.
Yeah, no, it's sort of like somebody who has experience, who's sharing that experience, but you're trying to do it. You have to do it in a way that's gentle. You can't go and be like, that's rubbish, you're going to look terrible in a jumpsuit.
To tell you the truth, in the beginning of my career, that the people were more resistant because I was not known.
Yeah.
And what is the value of my opinion? You're just someone that we heard of and we're going to try you out. But then now you sit and people, because they've seen your work on other people and they've seen how people look different in our clothes. So they say, no, they're coming because they trust our input. So this is also plays a big part.
Yeah.
But then again, you show her, okay, you tag along, you play along, you say, okay, I'm going to put on a jumpsuit on you and I'm going to put a dress on you and let's see which one will make your body looks nicer. So she sees the dress and she is convinced.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So she came out yesterday she's coming back today. I hope she doesn't change her mind.
Well, the good news, this wouldn't air until a couple
by the time we close the deal.
You'll close the deal first. Okay, Laish.
So she changed her mind and she's convinced because it's true that it makes her, and my interest to
100%.
I want her to look her best.
Sure.
I want her to remember to everyone to tell her, you looked awesome. So it's not my, I don't care if it's a jumpsuit or a dress, but I want to give her an honest opinion.
Yasmin's goal of wanting people to look their absolute best took a surprising turn last year when J.Lo picked out her dress for the premiere of her movie Hustlers. The story behind that, right after the short break. Hi guys, this is Hashim again, and I'm excited to share with you that we've launched our newest concept called Small.
It's based on a menu of, well, small indulgent dishes that you can mix and match. My personal favorite is the merguez in brioche, which is just divine. You will find Small among other locally born fabulous concepts like sticky rice, reef koshiaki, and boon coffee. Small is on the first floor of the food district at the Point on Palm Jumeirah. You can follow us at Small Dubai, that's SMOLDUBAI on Instagram, or drop us a line if you stop by. Welcome back. I'm Hesham Montasser, and you're listening to the Lighthouse Conversations with Yasmin Yaya, founder of Maison Yaya.
Let's talk about that famous yellow mustard dress that you designed for a certain someone. So you have kind of your J-Lo moment.
Yeah. Well, when I say the Reed story, everybody gets surprised. Everybody wants to hear that I went and I saw J-Lo and I measured her up and I told her, well, honey, what do you want me to do for you? Yeah, no, this is not what really happened.
Yeah, fair enough.
We have a lot of international stylists following us. And stylists usually scout the newest designers, the nice looks, and they gather probably like 50 looks for one event. Especially the bigger the celebrity is, the more choices she's gonna get. And then there will be a room where it's like 50 dress, and J-Lo will enter. I wasn't there, so that was in New York. And we send our stuff, the stylists call us, we have a fitting for, let's say, Beyonce, J-Lo, so many big names, by the way, we send things for. Not all of them are successful. But that day, apparently J-Lo picked the yellow mustard dress. And we didn't know. We just woke up one day, tagged, and we saw the dress.
They didn't tell you, by the way, she's... Yeah, you just literally found it on social media.
Woke up the day, and I looked at the Instagram. Or actually, the girl's handling the Instagram. It's me, right? It's like, what? She's like, J-Lo wore the... I was like, amazing. Thank God. Alhamdulillah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you and I had a discussion about this just earlier today, because I was saying, we were talking about moments like that, which I think you are describing it as luck. You know, I mean, sort of, you have to be lucky in your career. And my view was, the way I interpreted it is, it actually, you work very hard, you build a base, and then you position yourself so that you can get lucky. In other words, there is that base and the hard work that you've put up for that moment. That moment doesn't just happen out of nowhere. How do you feel about that? Do you feel like a moment like that is obviously, you already were successful and established even before Jennifer Lopez chose your dress. But of course, that moment put you probably on even higher pedestal. That came from a lot of hard work. Is that how you felt, or was your feeling more like, oh, I'm lucky, you know, there were 50 dresses and she just found mine?
I always feel gifted and lucky. And definitely, the hard work, I work hard, definitely. I mean, anyone who have established anything in any sort or any field, definitely they work hard. I mean, you cannot be noticed unless there is a lot of sincerity and in your work and integrity and a lot of seriousness in what you do. And you take it seriously. And this is how I take my job. I take my job very seriously. And not because I want to reach somewhere, but because I love it. And I love... Again, when I make a dress for, let's say, Hashim's wife, I want her I want to contribute into making things around me happier and better. So, but however, J-Lo could have walked that day. She probably, I don't know, someone stepped on her and this guy was wearing a yellow pants, yellow mustard pants. She said, no, I'm not into yellow mustard today, even though the dress looked good on her. Yeah. You know what I mean? So moments like these, and I really believe in the divine master planning, you know. And I think some things unfold in our careers, and some turns are taking because they're meant to be, and because this is where the divine master planning is planned for us.
And if you look forward from here, do you see yourself doing something differently, or would you want to, for the rest of your career, be doing just that? Do you see you growing the collection? Do you see yourself moving into other lines of art outside of fashion? I mean, you're obviously very multidimensional and multifaceted. You could do a lot of things.
During the Corona time, I never want to discount the artistic part and how I do my job. Definitely. This always, I want to stay no matter how we grow. And, I mean, one thing our house is known for, Maison Yaya is known for, is that the very customized, very family, very service-oriented way we deal with clients. And I'm definitely, being a businesswoman and someone who studied finance, I'm on the first steps of scaling. I'm thinking of scaling, and I'm thinking of introducing more ready-to-wear lines. I'm already actually currently working on that. And one of the main challenges that I'm actually thinking about and is how to take this brand value to scalability, because of course you're going to have to lose them in a way or another. But then this is something that I'm currently working on, and I don't want to lose it with.
You know, that's so fascinating. So before we started the Lighthouse, we spent about a year working on the values, which would sound a little bit ridiculous, but it really isn't, for very similar reasons. So our thinking at the time was, one is we were new into this business and we wanted to have almost like a Bible to go back to, right? So when I look at our menu development, our interior design, music, even the pieces, crockery, everything, we wanted to fall back on certain values. But then to your point exactly, as we look to scale and expand, that becomes even more important, because it doesn't mean that restaurant number two or location number three, or even if we do a cloud kitchen, should look identical to what we have in D3. But you want the values to be reflected.
To answer the same, to the same value.
So I'm trying to say that I think in your case, because I think you've defined the values quite well, even if you decide to kind of branch over and above to, you know, ready-to-wear or others, accessories, who knows, that value system will translate. Yes. It's just a matter of translating it into a new
exactly.
Something new.
So we're creating right now a ready-to-wear bridal line. And for example, we thought that high customizations, for example, usually when you buy any ready-to-wear dress, it is like that, and we cannot change anything about it. But to take the extra mile, to offer high customization on ready-to-wear, this is something that will deliver the values of our brand. Well, sometimes also, you know, between. When you study finance, a lot of these decisions definitely affect profitability, but sure. Then it comes again to your value. Who we are, do we want to make money regardless, or we want to make money and make people happy and
has
we
meaning
feel
to
happy.
You. Yeah, yes. Has meaning to you, yes. And your team. Yes. This is sort of related, but I hadn't realized that you grew up in Ismailia. We spoke about this now for a second. So I assumed you had grown up in Cairo. But you didn't. How that must have had, that's defining, because I don't know Ismailia very well. I've visited two or three times in my childhood. I know what it's like to grow up in Cairo, which is very, very different. I have a feeling, just from having met you a number of times now, that really is important to you, and in some ways has shaped the way you feel and think about things. Walk us a little bit through that, because Ismailia is not very well known.
So my dad used to be a marine pilot, okay. And he used to work in Suez Canal. So I was born in Suez. We stayed there 1 year, and then we moved to Ismailia, where he was working there for 14 years. And my mom is French. Ismailia is a French city.
100%.
I mean, the
French
house
influence,
is,
yeah, very strong French
it's
influence.
It's built by the French. Yeah. My dad, the Suez Canal, all the terminologies in my dad's job was... I mean, a day off was called a malade, you know.
Amazing.
We had the oldest French school, Saint Vincent de Paul, in Ismailia. It's a beautiful place to be, and we had a very nuclear. I mean, when I used to visit my cousins in Cairo, the idea that they're not along with the neighbors, or they don't know their,
or
they
don't,
they only know the neighbors of the building. We knew
everybody.
The whole place. I mean, my neighbor, she used to be my French teacher in school, and the other neighbors used to be next to me in class. And we grew up in a very nuclear society that I think installed a sense of
belonging, community,
belonging and values and beauty, and everything around us was really, really very beautiful. I mean, the trees, the mango trees of Ismailia, our house used to look at the Suez Canal. My dad, we used to pass by the ship and he used to do pee pee for us. Like, it was like a fairy tale. It was like, you know, the things that you see in the cartoon.
Yeah.
So we grew up in a very loving and beautiful environment. Yeah.
And then the transition to Cairo, you went moved to Cairo when you were 14?
We moved when I was 14, and when I was 14, we moved to Cairo, and it was a culture shock. It was a culture shock. People were so
sorry,
mean.
Sorry, I'm laughing. No. I almost feel sorry for you.
People were so mean, really, so mean. I was like, come on, man. Hold on, Annie. It's
I can tell you the exact, almost exact opposite story. So having grown up in Cairo, it's exactly as you said, which is completely hectic. When I moved to the States for college, I was in Boston first. And two things were, my first freshman year, I had two problems. One is I would tell my roommates, why is it so quiet? So in the evening, they'll be like, nothing, you can't hear anybody, there's no beeping. And I'm like, I can't sleep. And he's like, are you crazy? I'm like, no, I can't sleep. You know, I grew up in a place where it's honking nonstop, you know, every day, morning, evening. Number two, I was annoyed, I have to admit, by how nice people were.
Yeah.
So I found it really annoying that everybody was like, good morning, what's going on? So then when I moved to New York, I finally found myself.
Yeah.
Because New York was a bit like Cairo. People were mean, no one said hello.
Nobody
they were all
has
in
time
black.
For anyone. Yeah.
Exactly. No one had time for everyone. I was like, I found heaven. You know, you see.
That's why actually I like Dubai a lot. Yeah. I mean, because Dubai is like how I grew up. I mean,
In some ways. Or you can find that.
You can find that in Dubai.
Yeah. Where in Cairo, I don't think you can.
No, in Cairo, I love the vibrance of Cairo. I love that in living in Cairo, you can go every other... We have 3 days weekend, basically. And we go to Ain Sukhna, we go to Guna, we go to Sahel, we go... We have a nice lifestyle in Egypt, to tell
100%.
You the truth. The most beautiful beaches. But I love the calmness of Dubai, of the UAE.
Well, I think that's exactly the point. I don't think there's one that's bad and one that's good. I think it's A, what you're used to. So I was used to extremely vibrant, very fast-paced type of city living. And for many, many years, that's what I wanted. That's what I was seeking. Now, as I get a bit older, I'm starting to appreciate at a much later point in my life. I mean, so I'm 46. I was telling you earlier how now I go to the beach with my children, and that's a big highlight of the week for me. That didn't happen 10 years ago for a reason. So people adjust over the years, but I do think that your original years where you grew up are very defining in the way you look at things.
Definitely, 100%.
And I'm guessing that has even seeped into the subconscious of the work you do. In terms of,
I feel it all the time. I feel, and now actually, you know, some moments come back in your later life, and you remember some childhood memories. I'm actually so funny that I wanted to create a collection inspired from the things that I have screenshots of. Some architecture used to be in Ismailia. Moments of, you know, we have those huge mango trees under them in a nice breezy summer day, the smell. I want to recreate that feeling definitely in some of my collections. Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know if it was Ismailia, I think it was in Aswan, but I was reading at some point in the New Yorker an article about this famous nose that's developing perfumes. And Hermès developed this one particular perfume, which is lovely. And the mango smell was coming from Egypt. I think it was from Aswan. I'm not sure. I'm going to double check.
Yeah.
But it had such a huge influence on that nose, on the person working for Hermès, that he incorporated it. So these things really matter. Yeah, they really do matter.
Yeah, they go into our emotional memory. And after that, they get expressed in another form.
Let me just shift gears here for a minute and ask you a little bit about family life. You have twins, you're blessed with twin daughters. You obviously have a very busy work life, you travel, etc. How do you manage that? Do you bring them into everything and say the hell with it? You know, they'll see what happens and I'll have time. Or do you try to separate those neatly in terms of you have your work, maybe you come to your studio or your office or atelier here in D3, and then you go home and that's it. Do you separate or do you mix?
No, I separate.
You separate.
I separate.
Okay.
My girls, funny enough, like, I mean, everyone's dream to have their kids as an extension, okay?
Yeah.
So basically, if I'm a fashion designer, I want my kids to be playing around with the... I try to force them. They're tomboys.
Yeah.
They say, Mom, we don't like dresses.
Yeah.
We like games. And we like... So, no. Before, in the beginning, I used to be always feeling very guilty that I spent long hours at work. And it was such... Because I love my work and I love my kids. So I felt like I was cheating on my kids. Well, am I a bad mom because I love my work and I want to spend more hours to do this? And when I sit at home with my kids and I feel like something is slipping at work, I would say, am I a bad, what is it? And I used to feel guilty in the beginning, but now I kind of had this, I started feeling like, you know what, this over-romantic view that we need to spend all our time with the kids. I mean, it's only happened the past 200 years. After that, moms used to travel for like and then come back to their kids after 3 years, and people used to die early. I mean, kids need love, right?
100%. It's about love. It's not. Yes. I agree with you, yeah. And I also think it's a very oversimplified view of life, and unfortunately, one that disproportionately women have to deal with. I mean, but I feel fewer men. Society makes fewer men feel guilty about that,
yeah,
versus women. So
they started making you feel guilty now, huh? Let them do this to you.
It's catching up now. But, you know, yeah, it's okay for a husband or the father to be at work late or travel all the time,
yeah,
because he's earning a living for his family. When it comes to women, there's always a very different...
It's not true. Just make sure that your kids are getting love.
I think that's
the love
right.
can be from you, from the wife, from the grandmother, from the nanny also. Like, yeah, I'm not going to have my nanny raise the kids. Well, my nanny is part of us.
We're family.
Our nanny is family. She's to me, she's closer to me actually than a lot of other members of my family that I didn't see in a really long time. And if we don't have this familial mechanics and trust and love all between, so how come, I mean, she's in our lives, you know? So, no, I stopped feeling guilty.
Good.
But I love spending time with my kids. I mean, and I love spending time on my own also. So I always divide my day. So in the morning, I would go and sit with my kids before they go to school. Not out of duty, because I enjoy it. And then if I feel I worked too much, you know what? No, it's enough about work. I want to go back home and have a nice meal with my kids. So no, I don't think about it that much. And it is what it is. If I feel overworked and I feel I want to go back home, close the door and not see anyone, it is what it is.
And also remember, kids pick up what they want to pick up. I mean, my mother worked all her life. She was a university professor.
Yeah.
And I used to get upset when I was young because she'd come home, close the door in her room to correct exams. And I used to feel like, you know, why is she not spending time with us? And as I grew older, I appreciated that. And it gave me a lot of appreciation when I see my wife now working. And it's, funnily enough, same job. But so what I'm trying to say is I think kids, you have that feeling now, but they also see a working mother. And that's going to affect their decision-making and their views on women in
yes,
life.
And their and sense of independence also. I don't think that kids, I mean, if you look back in history, if you read in history, people used to go to war. Men used to go to war at the age of 13. It used to be men. We extended the childhood of kids, you know. People used to, when they said, what is child molesting? She used to get married when she's like 13. I mean, she was not a kid. She was a woman at that time. But more and more, we're extending the childhood of our kids, and we're discounting their abilities of being independent and understanding concepts and taking care of themselves even. Well, I don't do this with my kids, of course. I have someone sitting with them. But I mean, I believe that when you start raising your kids to be independent emotionally and give them a certain kind of strength to be able to decide things from themselves and not keep on spoon-feeding them, whether ideas or over-sheltering them, I think this is good for their development.
I completely agree. I think that's... And it's good that you can speak about this openly as well. I have one final question for you, and it has to do with your feta.
So I make a very good feta.
Yeah, apparently.
And you're going to try this very soon.
Yeah, I heard that you make a very good feta. So I'm going to use that as a symbol. What's your relationship with food? Because that's obviously something that's very important to you. We talked about this earlier.
I love food.
Because it has childhood memories for you, or is it because...
I think... Okay, so I have two relationships with food. One is very good and one is very bad. Okay, the one that is good is the one that has to do with the savoring, the beauty of this kind of sensory
The sensory part. The smell, the taste.
It's like music to my mouth, you know? Yeah. It's like when you listen to good music to your ears, when a good idea comes to your mind, and you know, this kind of
gives you pleasure.
Pleasure. So this is the good. And I love it. And I love tasting all kinds of food and closing my eyes and singing to the food and stuff like that. Which is a very sick relationship. But then there is also...
And that's the healthy part, mind you, yeah.
There is also the gluttonous. I mean, I think a lot of us now, even this modern day generation, we have a lot of emotional issues also.
100%.
So emotions and food and over or binge eating or, sure, you know... I think all of us have it. This is the bad relationship that I'm very aware of and I control from cyclically. Mm. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, you control.
In all cases, I'm a big consumer of good quality food and bad quality food.
Yeah. Look, you're not the only one. We had here a guest a couple of weeks ago who was a psychologist, and she deals with food disorders primarily. And of course, the pandemic didn't help. But I think all of us, as you said, have a relationship with food, but it can turn unhealthy. And I think the key is just to know where to stop.
So last week I was in the Lighthouse, and you should have seen me when I was tasting the goat cheese. The goat cheese salad. You should have. This has to be one of your ads. Singing to the goat cheese salad.
100%.
And that was the savory part.
Okay.
And then when the tofu, that was the gluttonous part. And I was like, okay, you know what? I'm full, but I have to take that. This is going to fix my mood for the rest of the day.
Now that I know.
You really have good food.
No, thank you. Thank you. Well, I mean, I feel like, maybe feta's in our cart, so we're going to sample
and
the feta
gonna,
soon, inshallah.
Very soon.
You can follow Maison Yaya and their work on Instagram at Maison Yaya, and you can find us on Instagram too, while you're there, at @thelighthouse_AE. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Lighthouse Conversations with me, Hesham Montasser. Our producer is Chirag Desai and our content director is Farah Al-Sharif. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it with one of your friends and leave us a review on Apple Podcast, as it helps more people discover the show. We'll see you in 2 weeks.